Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Mayor David Koss about visions of equality for Santa Fe, and we're going to be speaking to Jackie Mate about the Camera Obscura. Right now, I'd like to welcome composer, musician, researcher David Dunn. He is giving a concert this weekend at the Center for Contemporary Arts on Saturday at 8 in the evening, and then on Sunday giving a lecture on electronic music. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
So, electronic music... What are the first examples of, first of all, what is electronic music? It's not just when you put your, you plug your guitar into an amp.
Well, that's one form. The one way of looking at it is that almost all music we experience now is electronic in some form, just because of the media that serves as the intermediate conveyance to our ears. Certainly most people listen to most music over playback systems and through loudspeakers or in their car or some place where it's inherently electronic. But the term has gone through several stages of evolution. Nowadays, I think most people sort of conflate the history of that into the term what's called electroacoustic music, where sounds are taken from the world through sampling techniques or electronically computer-generated sounds, and these things are put together into some sort of structure that is then presented through loudspeakers or headphones or some kind of transducer system. But there's an older meaning to the term, and when we talk about the history of this, it isn't so much a genre as it is defined by the nature of the tools. So. There's a huge amount of work that's been done and currently being done almost to the point of absurdity, where the proliferation of genres have taken on, like if you think of more popular forms of electroacoustic music, with the electronica genre, it's almost a comical kind of proliferation of terms used to describe all these different genres. And I can't, even as a trained musician, can't half the time tell the difference between these different forms. But prior to the digital revolution in sound, there's a very long history that dates clear back to the late 19th century of people experimenting with electronic tools. And there's always a kind of tension that existed between the interests of commercial forces who were trying to imitate conventional instruments, more traditional instruments and voices, the forces of music making that we were all very familiar with. And that was in some kind of dialectic opposed to the kind of avant-garde or experimental thrust that was the interest of a lot of composers, where what they heard in these tools was the potential to create entirely new sounds, entirely new structures, to do things that musicians were never able to do, and to imagine new forms and genre. In the 20th century is largely a significant tension between these two different forms of interest. And it's been driven in different kinds of ways, and sometimes one side drives things and sometimes the other. So it certainly is true of something like the electric guitar and instruments that we associate with more popular forms, but still it's largely all technologically driven.
Well, there's always, when any new genre is invented, it seems like what they do first is they imitate the thing from which it came. So early movies imitated theater, and then they say, wow, movies have their own possibilities. And I would think it's the same with music. First, they sort of, like you have a theremin, which is a weird electronic instrument, but it kind of imitates existing instruments and tries to sound sort of classical. And then you have electronic music going off in a direction that doesn't, it goes into a realm somewhere between music and sound, if there is even a borderline there.
Yeah, and that's been the case from early on. One of the very first major electronic instruments that was conceived in the 20th century was an instrument called the telharmonium that an inventor named Thaddeus Cahill, who later went on to invent the electric typewriter, invented, and it was this gigantic thing. It filled I think something like 60 railroad boxcars when it was shipped to New York City at the beginning of the 20th century from Massachusetts, where he built it. And there, it weighed several tons, and it was before there were loudspeakers and before there were even vacuum tubes. So it was this gigantic, heroic construction that took him many years, and it was all with the intention of basically creating a subscription service in Manhattan that would go through phone lines to people's homes. And one of the first people to actually subscribe was Mark Twain. And this
what did it sound like?
Well, that was what was so interesting, was that it was conceived to basically sound, to imitate orchestral timbres, and it basically was a synthesizer. What we now think, if you could go even to a toy store now and you buy a Casio keyboard, well, this did about what a little Casio keyboard does now, only it took that immense amount of technology.
It was the size of a railroad car.
Well, of several. It actually occupied, I think, half a block in Manhattan. It was so gigantic. And there would be two people who would be playing these sort of popular classics in real time, and it would be transmitted over the phone lines. And unfortunately, it eventually went bankrupt because it was a little bit problematic, and then eventually was displaced by radio, of course. So it had a very short life, and we actually have nothing left except the patent diagrams, which then went on to be, I wouldn't say stolen, but highly influenced the inventor Hammond, who created the Hammond organ. But the Hammond organ was essentially a miniaturized version of all the designs and techniques once the materials became possible to miniaturize.
We're talking to David Dunn. So what is the role of the computer in electronic music?
Well, the computer has been a kind of it provided a way of creating more precise control and a way of focusing the control devices in a more specific way, something that could be more quantifiable and exact. And it also allowed for us to take the understanding we had of the physics that generated sound and put it into a more precise formulation. The effect of it overall has been, of course, to make these sounds and these kinds of systems more accessible to a larger number of people because of the manufacturing costs were reduced. But the other thing that it has done, I think, in a more formal way, is that it has kind of created a summary of all the techniques and all of the kinds of tools that existed throughout the 20th century. We're now able to describe those things in a mathematical and numerical form and formalize them in software so that most of the techniques, most of the sounds, most of the algorithms that were and different kinds of modulation or signal processing techniques that existed in the analog world prior to the computer now can be put into software form, and it makes it pretty easy. There was certainly a point where it was a very heroic endeavor to do computer music in the late 50s and early 1960s. At one point, there was only one D to A converter in the world, which was at Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Digital to analog.
To convert the numerical representation back into sound. It was a 12-bit converter, and everybody who wanted to do computer music, to actually turn it into sound, had to go to Bell Labs and use that converting system. And most of the music was being written in things like Fortran or even more primitive languages very early on, even in things like assembly in machine code, in a way that it really was time-consuming and very difficult to try to conceptualize. Well, but that changed really quickly.
Yeah. I mean, you're a classical violinist by training, and then you do all sorts of things in these realms. And I always wonder what happens when people get really obsessed with the tools, like the computer, and especially it's like this, it's sort of like this dude thing where you know, go into your hole and come out for, you know, days or weeks later with something that to the rest of the world just sounds like, you know, your FM dial on the static part of the station.
Well, yeah, and the industry depends upon that sort of techno lust to keep going, and they keep, of course, making incremental changes, and you sort of do see a class of musician whose lives are completely organized and self-identity is organized around the acquisition of these tools and constantly keeping up to date with the latest toys.
But I mean, do you get away from the musical part of it, or is that the, I mean, I would think that's a danger.
Well, it's a, I mean, that deserves a whole conversation just around the aesthetics of music and what we mean by that. In many cases, yes, it's certainly become something that dominates other considerations, where people just are interested in the nature of the tools themselves. And that's a certain kind of musician who really tries to unpack the potential of the tools, and that's their primary concern. But I don't think it really interferes with music in any way, in the sense that music has never existed as a kind of hierarchy. And we tend to, I think most people's relationship to music is sort of the same relationship they would have if they went to go buy a painting somewhere, a modernist work, and it's sort of what they're looking for is, you know, the right greens that match the sofa, or, you know, it's more to do with interior decorating. And I think in large part that's how most people regard music. It's just something they use to fill up their environment, and they have a certain kind of set of preferences, even use preferences, but their criteria is a pretty surface one that really only it's often just driven by a kind of group identity factor, where they listen to a certain kind of music because it helps them identify themselves in membership to some particular group, which is what I think one of the major functions that music has always had historically, even going back to Neanderthal, it's a way in which we define group membership.
I guess, but I don't know if you're giving the average person credit. I mean, there are people who really dig all sorts of music.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not even denigrating those particular uses. I just think that the use of music and the multiplicity of music has no end. I think it's one of the things that's extraordinary about it is we know of no human culture, either extinct or extant, that has not had a form of music. And it's something that it's one of the most profound ways we use to define what it means to be human. But it continually changes as we redefine what it means to be human. As we redefine our humanness, we make music that somehow reflects that.
Well, let's talk about the concert on Saturday night. That's in a couple of days, April 26th at 8 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. It's called Oscillate Osculate.
Which I didn't title it, so I'm not sure what
oh, you
it's
didn't?
Referring to, except I do know what the content of the concert will be. I think the first part is going to be Martin Back and Frank Rolla are going to be doing a I don't know how long a set of works that they're working on, which is generated out of homemade and self-designed circuitry, and that's sort of the theme of the evening, is that there's a lot of music made with commercial tools that are widely available, and there's a kind of redundancy that sets in because of the nature of these shared tools. And
meaning what? The nature of the tools makes people use them in a way that's similar?
Yes, very much drives the kind of music that's being made, and that's certainly true of a lot of what's available in terms of commercial software and even hardware tools. It lends a certain homogeneity to the result and a redundancy to the result. And so there's been a fairly strong movement for a number of years. Well, I mean, in the largest sense, it goes back to the very beginnings of all of this, where there was nothing available, and composers and musicians who were interested in this had to invent their own tools from scratch. And that's still an active a domain of this kind of music, and a lot of people and a lot of very famous practitioners, someone like David Tudor, for instance, who was the major performing musician associated with John Cage throughout Cage's lifetime, started out as a concert pianist doing very experimental works, specializing in that, and eventually stopped playing the piano and went on to become an electronic music composer in his own right. And all of his music was essentially constructed from this menagerie of electronic circuits that he designed and built. And it would be sort of, you see him performing, it would be these tables filled with all these boxes of strange circuits and all this stuff that no one really understood except for David. And he'd be buried in the midst of this, pushing buttons and turning dials, and these extraordinary sounds would result. So there's always been that kind of an interest, and particularly right now, there's a very large return to that kind of focus.
Now, if you make your little homemade circuit, does it have its own sound the way a particular flute or violin has its own sound?
Oh, it certainly can. In fact, that was one of the sort of insider bits of knowledge of composers when the first commercial synthesizers came about. There were definitely not only preferences for different kinds of machines, because of how they were designed differently and therefore had different ways of interacting with how you would interface with them, but also the sounds are really different. Just something as basic as different kinds of op amps and transistors would produce different kinds of spectral characteristics, and people who were really tuned to that really knew the difference. And so, yes, the answer is these funny little black boxes filled with odd custom circuits produce a huge range of different kinds of sounds, and sounds that are often extremely different, and sounds that actually can't be achieved any other way except by building these unique circuits.
Now, and so you will be performing that night as well.
And I'll be doing the larger set for the evening, and it'll be works that are all generated from that, also from the same kinds of materials. Circuits that I've been building recently, which are, I'll be performing with them, but they're circuits that are actually designed primarily to be the core of self-generating autonomous sound sculptures that can interact with natural systems or interact with other musicians or whatever. But
will you be explaining this as it goes
along?
A little
bit. I'll be explaining a little bit of it. Yeah, I mean, it gets technical really fast, but basically the ideas are these are circuits with enough inherent complexity that you turn the power switch on and they start to create self-organizing behaviors that are literally infinite in their characteristics. There's no end to them.
Well, this is all happening this weekend, Saturday, April 26th, a concert at 8 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts, and then Sunday, April 27th, you will be giving a lecture at 2 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts. For more information, 982-1338, extension 22, which is Martin Back, who's one of the performers.
Yes.
David Dunn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Shirley.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Mayor David Koss. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Mayor David Koss. He will be giving an address tonight. That's tonight, isn't it?
No, it's tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, it's April 25th. Yes,
yeah.
I know what day it is.
At scared me.
What day is it? So Friday night, tomorrow, at Tipton Hall, called Visions of Equality for Santa Fe. And this is part of the Beyond the Lecture series. In fact, it's the last lecture in this wonderful series that's been put on by the College of Santa Fe. So the Visions of Equality for Santa Fe, it seems like equality is an ideal that kind of went down the tubes when Ronald Reagan was elected.
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
What do you mean by equality? And let's start with, what is the nature of the inequality that we have in Santa Fe?
Well, I think the nature of the inequality in Santa Fe is primarily economic. There's such a vast concentration of wealth in this country, and it shows in Santa Fe. It shows in the struggles we have over the living wage or the affordable housing ordinances, just disparities between South Side and East Side, those kinds of issues. I think it's showing more and more. It's funny that you mentioned Ronald Reagan. It just seems like as a as a political culture, we decided to destroy our middle class and destroy our ability to maintain a decent standard of living. We can't do education. We can't do infrastructure. We can hardly do police.
Yeah, which has been in the news lately.
I've been purposely trying to get that in the news lately.
What is the status of the middle class? Has it been shrinking in Santa Fe just like everywhere else?
It's been shrinking in Santa Fe just like everywhere else. I heard an interesting comment on the radio a few days ago. A guy was talking about his summer job, which amounted at the time in early 70s to $24,000 a year. And he was saying that same job, if it was inflation adjusted now, would pay $184,000 a year. So how many middle class people make $184,000 a year?
Right.
And that's how much we've been running in place as a society. Productivity's gone up, economic output has gone up, and yet the working families are ever more squeezed, trying to pay for housing, trying to pay for food, trying to pay for health care, trying to pay for education.
I think one of the things that's hard about being the mayor of a city is that you can't do that much about the root causes, which are national and international. You just have to try to put in programs that mitigate as best you can the problems that you really can't affect. What are some of the programs go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think a lot of the solutions to our issues are at a local level. And I'm hopeful that we'll have a better president next year and that we'll be able to, again, form partnerships with the federal government. But that has not been the case for so long now that I think municipalities, cities, and counties have, they really stopped. Our position with the federal government is, could you just at least leave us alone?
When you say a lot of the best solutions come at the local level, what are some examples?
Yeah. Well, I think our living wage ordinance is a great example. Santa Fe now has the highest minimum wage in the country. It applies to everyone. We haven't seen a decrease in business activity or an increase in unemployment related to that ordinance at all, but we do know that about 10,000 workers have received a pay increase to at least $9.50 an hour. I think our affordable housing ordinance put us into a position with some of the moves that we've made with developers around annexation to where we actually have affordable housing in the pipeline.
For which we won a prize recently.
For which we've won a prize from the Harvard School of Government, Kennedy School of Government, recognizing it. We've won another prize from the U.S. Conference of Mayors DollarWise program for some of the work we do with housing groups in town. So those things, you can start to see them work. We put together an economic development strategy that we've been pursuing, and we are a successful community in art and culture, in healing arts, medicine, in technologies, different technologies, and publishing. So local governments can start to do these things.
And yet you're always under attack, for example, the latest suit by the Home Builders Association.
We are always under attack, or we are often under attack. But this community when the city council passed that ordinance, they did their research for a long time. So we expect that we were sued by the living wage, on the living wage. We won. Now we're sued on our affordable housing ordinance. We expect that we'll win again. I'm very proud of working with the business community in Santa Fe, because last year, we reached a compromise with the business community on the living wage. It now applies to everyone. It's going to go up with the cost of living next year. And that was agreed to amazingly by the lodgers, by the restaurants, by the Chamber of Commerce. So this is a cutting edge community with a different kind of business community as well.
how have you been seeing and handling the questions of immigration? I understand that you are introducing some legislation in the U.S. Conference of Mayors on immigration.
We've been working with that, with our the city's immigration committee and with Somos Un Pueblo Unido. And, I've had opportunity through the Conference of Mayors to talk about this issue with mayors around the country, and it's a controversial issue everywhere. But I think all of us, again, are tired of waiting for federal help, for a sane federal policy on that. And so I think Santa Fe, back in 1999, drafted a pretty sane policy.
What is the nature of our policy?
With Councillor Boucher was the woman that introduced that then. Our policy is that, basically I describe it as we follow the U.S. Constitution, and it's everybody that lives here has constitutional rights. And sometimes people say, oh, only citizens have constitutional rights. I say, go back and read the Constitution. Yeah. That's not what it says.
Yeah.
And so we've done a lot of work. Our police department is very well trained, and we don't enforce federal immigration law. We do public safety. We intervene on domestic violence, on burglary, on drug smuggling, and we don't ask what your immigration status is. And that's the basic policy. We try to treat everybody the same, regardless of immigration status.
I think it's important to point out every once in a while that immigration violations are civil violations and not criminal violations.
Exactly.
And so the police department doesn't really have any job in the first place.
There's not really a role there. And people try to push us there. ICE tries to push us there. And we've had some pretty good discussions. Actually, our police chief has with ICE about their operations in Santa Fe. I just think this is a serious test of our national character. And when we see our federal police breaking up families, when we see moms and dads disappearing, they did a raid here last year. It took me, I think, 4 months and the intervention of Senator Bingaman and Congressman Udall to find out what happened to those working families that were arrested in Santa Fe. Those people are part of our community, and for them to just disappear off the streets like that, to me, that's a frightening thing.
It's a frightening thing, and having just had this wonderful exhibition that disappeared in at Site Santa Fe, scariest implications of secret police coming and taking people away to secret detention centers.
I think it is a disturbing thing when you hear people seriously planning to arrest 12 million people, and you hear companies getting plans ready for what kind of camps can we keep them in before we deport them. When you hear moms and dads, the kids come home from school and they're gone. And you just hear some of the nasty rhetoric around this. To me, it's a little disturbing. We used to call that fascism. Now you're not supposed to say that. But I think that's not the United States I grew up in. And I think we need to keep putting that issue out. There'll be a rally tonight or a vigil organized by Somos Un Pueblo Unido, and I intend to make an appearance there and speak on this issue.
Is that on the plaza?
It's at El Parque.
At El Parque.
Yeah, by Guadalupe Parish.
Which is on...
DeVargas Park, over by the Cowgirl.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We're talking to Mayor David Koss. Now, one of the platforms that you ran on when you were running for mayor was the restoration of the Santa Fe River. How's that going?
I think that's going really well. I'm very encouraged by the continuous upwelling of community support for that. This week, the Santa Fe Watershed Association unveiled the signs. It seems like a simple thing, but just putting a sign, hey, you're at the Santa Fe River, on all the river crossings in the county, I think it's just a very kind of a profound statement that, oh yeah, we have a river. And you know, for the first 400 years of our existence, it was the center of the community. And then we kind of forgot about it and let it be degraded, purposely degraded it in some cases. But now the city, the people in the community more and more are saying, well, we want it back. We think it's important that it be back. Had a very interesting talk with a young man that's a youth leader in the YouthWorks program, and he just made the comparison or the analogy that as the river disappeared from consciousness in the city, so did the youth. And if you were going to get in trouble as a young person, the place to do it was down in the river, because the people didn't see the river and they didn't see the young people. And so now we have the same young man and YouthWorks working on restoring the river. And they're really working on restoring a river that some of us older folks saw, they never saw.
Right.
And so they're planting willows, they're cleaning up trash, they're putting in grade control structures to stop the erosion and start bringing the river back. Those are all just, to me, very hopeful signs when you see kids and old people and the Watershed Association that's brought in a lot of money from businesses to keep the work going. Now we're looking at having flows in the river and maybe being able to extend them all summer long. So I see a lot of progress on that.
I mean, flow is the issue. Ultimately, is there going to be actual water in the river?
Well, yeah. How much water does the river have? How much do we put to keeping a good ecological function through the center of the city?
So there's another thing I want to talk to you, which was the issue of green collar jobs. We know blue collar jobs and white collar jobs.
Yeah.
Is the green sector in Santa Fe a reality or an about to be one?
It's a reality. It's a fledgling reality now. That's an area that is just very exciting for people in the labor movement and social justice movements and environmental movements to focus on. I've been working with the Santa Fe Alliance, Vicky Pozzebon and her group, to invite Van Jones from Oakland. That's a city that's really ramping up the green collar jobs. They're helping, you know, middle class families, working class families, retrofit their homes, put in solar where they can, insulate, become super energy efficient. At the same time, you're training those same households, those same communities, you're training workforce for jobs that are going to just become more and more important. So we've invited some members of that community to come work in Santa Fe, and there's a lot of people now trying to figure out, so how do we finance this? How do we do the training? And I just think, you know, again, YouthWorks, Earth Care International, Boys and Girls Club, they're all looking at the training, the workforce training and the job opportunities that are going to be in this as local communities step up, where the federal government, again, has just been an abysmal failure, and say we do want to do something about carbon emissions and greenhouse gases.
So the title, once again, of your lecture tomorrow night at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock is Visions of Equality for Santa Fe. So listening to the program now are people at virtually all levels of income and prosperity. What is the role of each citizen in helping to make that vision more real instead of just, you know, staying in our little houses, be they big or small or whatever?
Well, I think a lot of that is don't stay in your little house. You know, Santa Fe is such an amazingly rich and active and diverse community. You know, I would say people get involved in it. And I've been really pleased and honored as mayor to see a lot of that. You know, later this morning I'm going to be going over to Vanessi's. It's Human Services Week at Vanessi's, and the Rape Crisis Center and the Esperanza Center and the City of Santa Fe are all working with the business community to create a safe haven program to really reach out to people affected by domestic violence, sexual violence. And that's just an example of what you see that you can become involved in Santa Fe.
Well, Mayor Koss, it's wonderful to have you on the air. Any last words that you want to tell our people before we go?
Have a great day. It's finally springtime in northern New Mexico.
It's the most beautiful green and flowering trees everywhere in our wonderful city. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Once again, tomorrow night at Tipton Hall, 7 o'clock, Visions of Equality for Santa Fe. Mayor David Koss will share his vision with the public. We're going to take another little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. We're going to be talking about camera obscura. I'd like now to welcome Jackie Mate. She's a photographer and teacher, and she's inviting the community to a camera obscura on Sunday, the
27th.
This coming Sunday, the 27th, from 2 to 4 at 1210 Louisa Street in observance of Worldwide Pinhole Day, and this is all sunshine permitting. What is a camera obscura?
Well, it actually is translated in Latin as a darkened chamber. But what we're really going to do is darken out several of the rooms in a music studio at 1210. It's the Santa Fe Strings Music Studio has donated their space. And we leave one pinhole available in the window. And what happens is the image outside is projected upside down and backwards into the room, and you actually are inside of it experiencing it.
Now, this is an amazing thing probably to many of our listeners, which is if you darken a room, you punch a hole in the wall, everything that's outside will be projected on the wall opposite the hole.
It's really fascinating because when you really think about it, you just think the room will have a little bit of light in it.
Yeah, you think there'd be a dot on the wall.
That's right, or just a faint light in the room, and it would be slightly dark, but it is a phenomenon. It's very magical. It sort of takes you unexpectedly off your feet, usually. So most people are really fascinated by it. And it's just wonderful to be inside of the room and be able to really study how light moves and how images are really created inside of a camera.
Now, this is the same principle that a camera, not a digital camera, but your traditional, any other kind of camera uses that has film in it, and also the same process that goes on in your eye. Is that correct?
That is correct, and even in digital. It's really light, you know. Photography, whatever form it takes, it's really painting with light. And it is what takes place in your eye. I think Da Vinci, it goes way back in to like 300, 500 BC, philosophers have documented, Aristotle and Chinese philosophers have documented this process in their journals, and Da Vinci really connected it to the eye and how it moves and how the light enters the eye and images are created.
So what do we know about the first or the early cameras obscura, I guess you would say?
Well, I think it would actually be camera obscura or something,
right,
something more like that. And you know, the earliest ones that have been written about, I think, probably go back to like Middle East with the nomads when they would travel through the desert. Their tents, they had holes in them so that in the heat of the day they could rest, but they could also watch the horizon for approaching people and things like that. In the Renaissance, it was used as a drawing aid. They made smaller laptop versions. So Vermeer and a lot of other, you know, artists, pardon me, used that technique. They also designed cathedrals with them in it, where the calendars were created by tracking the sun moving from the pinhole in the dome above across the cathedral floor. And even in the 1800s, sort of a pre-cinematic entertainment situation, they would pop up pavilions along beaches and things like that where, again, you could take a break from the sun and watch the waves roll in.
So if the scene outside is moving, people walking by or the waves, then you have actually a moving image on the wall.
You would have like the waves rolling in on the ceiling and seagulls flying around on the floor. And
wow.
It gets more distorted as it hits the corners of the room, so it's kind of, you know, you really can see how it happens. I think they even had some in Central Park in the early 1800s, so there's been postcards found of pictures of them.
And so we're doing one here in Santa Fe on Sunday.
Yay.
From 2 to 4 at 1210 Louisa Street. Now, you are also, you do not only this camera obscura, which is a one-day thing, but you're also doing a pinhole photography workshop or camp this June, and is it, I guess, just the month of June?
It is. It's two extended weekends in a row. I've done the camp before where we've run it in a week, but this year's new. We're separating it. The first week is weekend. It's Thursday through Sunday, evenings and weekend days. And the first weekend is designed towards building a camera. We build a super wide 4x5 format camera that accepts a 4x5 film holder and a Polaroid holder, so it really becomes a working tool. And we experiment with testing the imagery and making images and printing it in cyanotype. The second extended weekend is a lot more intensive image making and printing.
And so what is cyanotype?
Cyanotype is similar to blueprinting. It's an alternative process that goes back pretty far, and it's the wonderful thing about it is that it's so accessible. It's very affordable. You can coat your own papers with the solution, and it exposes right in the sunshine, and you develop it in water. So it's very friendly and easy to use, and wonderful results.
Now, pinhole cameras, one thinks of early 20th century, you know, people walking around with these big boxes, and you've got some of these wonderful boxes. Why still use them when you can use digital photography and this little tiny camera that fits in the palm of your hand?
Oh, there's so many reasons, Mary Charlotte. I love the imagery that comes with it. With pinhole photography, it requires a longer exposure because the light is so dim. Really, the cameras that we make, the f-stop, if you're familiar with photography at all, is equal to 270. So it's infinite depth of field, all over focus, and with the long
exposure. But a very tiny hole.
A very tiny hole, yeah. And the exposure is so long that it allows this time factor to enter in, so things can happen that you didn't really plan on. And it's full of wonderful surprises and incredible imagery. So I do love it. And, you know, not to knock the other, I think there's a place in the world for the digital and the high tech and the simple form of it. And I love to teach with the pinhole because I think that it really gives you just a very basic, simple idea of what photography is about in a world where it's become so technical that everyone's a photographer, but not many people really understand what they're actually doing.
Well, it's hard to understand the circuits of a digital camera and how it is that whatever the thing is that receives the light. But when you have a box with a hole in it and a piece of film,
that's right,
you get to teach and understand. Well, let me ask you this. How do young people, have you been teaching school kids?
I have been teaching school kids, and this camp is geared for 12 and up. And interestingly enough, I tend to attract more adults or adults with children. In fact, I'm working on a series of workshops over the summer through CYFD for foster kids, and combining it with potential adoptive families where they work together on a project. And when I work with younger kids, we typically don't build such an elaborate camera as we do at this camp. I often have them bring in their own vessel, so it becomes a variety of tins and things like that, and it's really fascinating to see what kind of photographic or personality each vessel contains. So you get this very extreme version of people's vision. So it's a wonderful thing.
The work with the foster kids is so interesting because it's an extension of the Heart Gallery.
That's
which
right.
You have a lot of personal connection to.
I do have a lot of personal connection to. Diane Granito's been a big part of our life, and we've adopted through the Heart Gallery, and I've been a volunteer photographer for it since the beginning, and it's an incredible organization, and I'm really excited to work with them. I think the kids will love it, and I think it would be a great thing, not just for the kids, but for the adults and for them together, and if something should blossom, they have that tool to start creating memories that they can hold on to with.
So how did you start out in photography? Were you always working with the sort of lowest tech, like, I don't know if you can even call it, but, you know, pinhole and things like that?
No, not at all. In fact, I actually started more as an artist and moved into photography. I'm pretty much self-taught, but I've always sort of, when you're in the business, sometimes you hear people say things like, bring all your equipment to the shoot. You know, you want to impress them. Set it all up, even if you don't use it. And I don't know. It all seems sort of silly to me. And I've always sort of gradually leaned towards simplifying. And I've shot a lot of film. I'm in the digital world now, but this is where my heart is. It's just to me, it's the essence of it, and it's something that I don't have complete control over, and that's something I've never ever really wanted as an artist. I'm not technical at all, and it's just nice to have nature have a hand in my work.
If you're working, let's say, with pinhole photography, and you have a very long exposure that's part of the deal, you must have to choose your subject differently than when you're working with more high-tech equipment.
I think you do, but you know, it's interesting. Like, for example, tourist type photography. A lot of times you don't want to take that picture of the cathedral because there's a lot of people in front of it. With a long exposure, the people are moving and virtually they disappear, and you end up
A
very crowded situation with a picture of a cathedral with hardly anyone there. So
what happens to the people? I mean, are they just like ghostly?
Yeah. You know, you have to have stayed still for at least half of the exposure to even show up as a ghost. So if you have a minute long or a 2 minute long exposure, usually people are moving enough that they do disappear. And if someone sits there, you may have a ghost or two in the shot.
Do you feel like you're drawn to old-fashioned subject matter?
No, not at all. Everything. It opens up. Everything's different. Everything's new and fresh. So yeah, that, but also everything else. I think it's inspired me more than anything in my photographic history. So.
We're talking to Jackie Matei, and the Camera Obscura is going to be this Sunday from 2 to 4 at 1210 Louisa Street in observance of Worldwide Pinhole Day. And then the Camp Obscura is going to be Thursday, June 12th, and that whole weekend, and then the following weekend, Thursday, June 19th through Sunday. And it's children 12 and up, adults 12 and up,
that's
whatever
right.
You would call it. Now, you were talking the other day about how you were hoping to get people to work on a project together in the camp.
Yeah, that's always my goal is to bring everyone together. They do their imagery individually, but have something that they come together on in one project towards the end of camp. And my goal is to do a series of short animations through the pinhole, where each student or each participant would deliver 6 to 12 images, and once they're all put together and strung together, you would have, you know, a short little spot. So that's my idea right now.
And the animation would be made in film?
Probably digitized. And so that's one of the other things that we do in camp. We print in alternative processes and we use pinhole, but we also, for quick viewing, we take our negatives that we've developed and we scan them digitally so that we can critique our work as we go along. So that kind of thing really excites me. And working with alternative processes and knowing that the computer is used to produce digital negatives that are used for printing, and that it's just nice to see the marriage of the two, to me, two different mediums.
Jackie Matei is a photographer and teacher. For more information, what number should they call?
They should call 505-231-3758. And can I say the website?
Yep, campobscura.com.
That's right.
Jackie, that's right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Mose Allison. And coming up on April 30th, the Good Morning Jazz 8th Anniversary Show. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. Today is Thursday. Tomorrow is Friday. That means Robert Knott will be here, which is always great fun. And the wonderful Mary Lou Cook, who is a living treasure. Okay, all that and much, much more on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Ciao.